Russia unleashes a wave of drone strikes on Kyiv as the Ukrainian capital prepared to celebrate the anniversary of its founding.
Typically, this day is filled with street fairs, live concerts, special museum exhibitions, and sporting events.
Plus, a hopeful President Joe Biden says he and the top House Republican have struck a debt limit deal to avert a crisis with little time to spare.
The agreement prevents the worst possible crisis, a default, for the first time in our nation's history.
And a project to find concrete ways to improve education for kids in Kenya's informal settlements. Today is Monday, May 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. With only days to spare, U.S. President Biden briefed reporters Sunday on a negotiated deal to raise the nation's debt ceiling.
It takes the threat of catastrophic default off the table, protects our hard-earned and historic economic recovery, and the agreement also represents a compromise, which means no one got everything they want. But that's the responsibility of governing.
Now Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy will work to ensure they have enough Republican and Democratic votes to pass the measure in the coming week. VOA's Veronica Balteras Iglesias has details on a deal that has in principle been struck.
The deadline to increase the borrowing authority of the United States is drawing closer. But some members of Congress are hopeful the nation won't run out of cash. Interviewed on Fox News, Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy praised the deal he struck in principle with President Joe Biden in the past hours.
You've got work requirements to help people out of poverty into jobs. You've got reforms that we can build things, cut the red tape. We capped so the president can't just spend money wildly. We're actually spending less than we spent last year. That hasn't happened in Congress. So maybe it doesn't do everything for everyone, but this is a step in the right direction.
Despite some legislators taking to social media to criticize the deal, Republican Representative Dusty Johnson told CNN's State of the Union program that he's heard from several mainstream conservatives that they'll vote in favor.
There will be Freedom Caucus people who vote for this package. So when you're saying that conservatives have concerns, it is really the most colorful conservatives. Overwhelmingly, Republicans in this conference are going to support the deal. How could they not? It is a fantastic deal.
The expansion of work requirements for some recipients of food stamps has raised concerns among some Democrats. Among them, Representative Pramila Jayapal, who also appeared on CNN.
Actually, by some estimates, creates a burden on administrative spending that is actually worse for, you know, for the overall cost of a program like that. Number two, it is about people who are hungry, people who just need a little bit of temporary assistance.
Before voting in favor of the deal, Jayapal says she'll need more details.
In terms of the exemptions that were put in, for veterans, for folks who are experiencing homelessness, for people who are coming out of foster care.
When pressed by a CBS anchor on whether he'll get all the votes needed and can guarantee the U.S. won't see a default, House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries didn't hesitate.
Yes.
The deal will have to pass both the House and the Senate. The Treasury Department has warned that the debt ceiling must be raised by June 5th. So the United States can cover all its financial obligations. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Russia unleashed waves of airstrikes on Kyiv overnight in what officials said appeared to be the largest drone attack since the start of the war, as the Ukrainian capital prepared to celebrate the anniversary of its founding on Sunday. As VOA's Miroslava Gungadze reports from Kyiv, despite a sleepless night, residents defiantly marked the day.
On the night of May 28, Kyiv became the target of an unprecedented two-wave air attack unleashed by Russia. The attack came on Kyiv Day, celebrated on the last Sunday of May every year to mark the city's founding 1,541 years ago. Typically, this day is filled with street fairs, live concerts, special museum exhibitions, and sporting events. The Ukrainian military, equipped with improved Western-supplied air defense systems, successfully intercepted and destroyed at least 40 drones. However, falling debris claimed the life of 41-year-old man and injured 35-year-old woman, according to the city mayor. This was the 14th airstrike by Russian on Kyiv in single months. Several districts, including the historic Pechersk neighborhood, bore the brunt of the overnight assault. Despite the airstrike, Ukrainians keep their spirit up with unbroken resilience and determination to stand firm in the face of Russian aggression.
For me, it's like usual things of our life. It's like tomorrow they send, yesterday we'll send, today we'll send the drones. It's like the usual, like a morning coffee and night drone attacks. It's our life.
Actually, today in the morning, after that sleepless night, one more sleepless night, I was thinking that our tiredness is nothing in comparison with the guys who protect us on the line of front. So I think we don't have any right to cry or to give up, because if we will give up, then what is the reason for our defenders to stay there? I think we should be strong in order to support them.
You know, I'm celebrating life and Kyiv birthday too, because tomorrow was a terrible night, so we have to split our blood and calm down.
Well, apparently there was a drone attack last night. I blissfully slept through it, and this morning I'm going for a run. I'm not going to give Putin and the Russians the satisfaction of disrupting my life.
Мирослава Гунгадзе, VOA News, Kyiv, Ukraine. Following Russia's massive attack using Iran-made drones, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky Sunday introduced a bill proposing additional sanctions against Iran for 50 years. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan won re-election Sunday, extending his increasingly authoritarian rule into a third decade. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Even before the official confirmation of his victory, supporters of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan quickly gathered outside his Istanbul home to celebrate. Turkey's electoral board later confirmed his victory, giving him more than 52% of the vote against challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Erdogan, speaking to his supporters on a campaign bus, thanked them for his success. He said, "I would like to thank all our citizens who showed their will for the future, both for themselves and their children, by casting their votes in the elections." Challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, reacting to the reported results, criticized the process.
Son yılların en adil olmayan seçim sürecini yaşadık.
He says, "We've experienced the most unfair election in recent years. All the means of the state were mobilized for a political party. All possibilities were laid under one man's feet. Nearly all of Turkey's mainstream media are under Erdogan's control, which provided scant coverage of Kılıçdaroğlu's campaign." While expressing sadness for what he said were the troubles that awaited Turkey, Kılıçdaroğlu struck a defiant tone.
"Sizlerden bir ricam var."
He says, "I have a request from all of you. Please, let's keep the struggle for democracy alive for yourself, your children, the retirees, our mothers and fathers, our farmers and tradesmen." Erdogan's opponents warned that a renewed mandate would likely lead to more crackdowns on critics and a further slide into authoritarian rule. Still, Erdogan, speaking to supporters, said his victory was for everyone.
"Biz öyle bir kazanacağız ki..."
"We said that we will win in a way that no one will lose. That's why Turkey is the only winner today." Russian President Vladimir Putin was among the first to congratulate Erdogan, referring to him as a dear friend and saying the Turkish people appreciate what Putin referred to as Erdogan's independent foreign policy. Much to the concerns of Turkey's traditional Western allies, Erdogan has developed a close relationship with Putin, despite Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It is a relationship that Erdogan pledged to deepen as he campaigned for re-election. The Turkish leader also promised to continue his unorthodox economic policies, which plunged the country into crisis with soaring inflation and mounting pressure on the weakened lira. Initial reports of Erdogan's success saw the value of the currency slip on international markets. markets. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
China's Minister of Commerce was in the United States last week, meeting with the U.S. Commerce Secretary, as well as the U.S. Trade Representative. The meetings came just days after President Biden signaled a thaw in bilateral relations with Beijing. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report.
A clear signal from President Joe Biden on U.S.-China relations.
This silly balloon that was carrying two freight cars worth of spying equipment was flying over the United States, and it got shot down, and everything changed in terms of talking to one another. I think you're going to see that begin to thaw very shortly.
What Biden called silly was the Chinese espionage balloon that flew over American territory in February, an incident that caused bipartisan uproar and led to the cancellation of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's scheduled visit to Beijing.
It's a violation of our sovereignty. It's a violation of international law.
But in a meeting with Chinese foreign policy official Wang Yi in Vienna earlier this month, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the U.S. is looking to move beyond the incident. Other top-level engagements followed, including a meeting between Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo and her Chinese counterpart Wang Wentao on Thursday. Wang also met with U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai on Friday.
To have these channels open, I think, is a fundamental component to our strategy towards China, which now is basically a combination and a delicate balance.
Beyond the desire to show that it can manage great power competition with China and to seek cooperation on issues from fighting climate change to stopping fentanyl trafficking, Yun said Washington is looking for Beijing to be a constructive force in the war on Ukraine. Meanwhile, China is seeking to leverage a transactional relationship on issues it cares about, including U.S. restrictions on semiconductor technology. A mutual driving force for warming ties is the APEC leaders' meeting that the U.S. will host in San Francisco in November. Dennis Wilder, former National Security Council's director for China, now a senior fellow for the Initiative for U.S.-China Dialogue and Global Issues at the Georgetown University via Skype.
For Xi Jinping, who feels as if he is one of the founders of APEC, or China is, he really wants to be at that meeting. And having Xi there without Putin will be a big feather in the cap of the Biden administration.
Should Xi attend APEC, there's opportunity for a separate summit with Biden, their second face-to-face engagement as presidents since the pair met at the sidelines of the Group of 20 meeting in Bali last November. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News at the White House.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Saudi Arabia and the United States called on Sunday for the extension of a ceasefire deal that brought some let-up in a six-week war between Sudan's military factions, but little humanitarian relief for civilians. Clashes continue in the capital, Khartoum, as human rights monitors report deadly fighting in one of the principal cities in the western region of Darfur. The Taliban and Iran exchanged heavy gunfire Saturday on the Islamic Republic's border with Afghanistan, killing and wounding troops while sharply escalating rising tensions between the two countries amid a dispute over water rights. And U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris made history over the weekend, becoming the first woman to deliver a commencement speech at West Point Military Academy, lauding graduating cadets Saturday for their noble sacrifice in serving their country. She said they were entering an unsettled world because of Russian aggression and the rising threats from China. This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. International nonprofit CFK Africa has been chosen as one of 10 global partners with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, to study concrete ways to improve educational outcomes among students living in Kenya's informal settlements. I spoke with CFK Africa Interim Deputy Director of Strategic Initiatives in Nairobi, Jeffrey Okoro, about how they're going about it.
So CFK Africa has won a bid to basically join in partnership with Massachusetts Institute of Technology to study evidence-based solutions to improve educational outcomes among students in Kenya. What does that look like for your organization now? What is the next step in how you go about that?
Right. So MIT is basically has linked CFK with research fellows and social fellows to help identify the best, basically to identify three key things, which is how do we get valid data that helps us be able to prove our hypothesis that providing interventions help kids stay in school. It's helping us to identify what level of evidence is necessary to judge which practices are most effective and, you know, how can causation be reasonably inferred, especially when there are lots of variables that affect student attendance and learning.
How big of an issue is it in Kenya for children to not necessarily finish their education?
Currently in Kenya, there's a majority of residents, just about in Nairobi, over 60% of the residents live in informal settlement and they cannot access enough government schools, so they depend on informal schools. And the challenge in informal schools is that they do not have the characteristics that would help kids have quality and education and also finish school. And what we're addressing is the issue that about 60% of the entire student population in Kibera go in informal schools but are likely not to finish school. And so we are looking at a population of just about 45,000 students being affected directly by the work that we are doing with the Best Schools Initiative. That is the project that we've pitched to MIT. That's in Kibera alone, which is just one informal settlement of the 1,400 that exist in Kenya.
Have you come up with any thoughts and ideas yet on some of the Best School Initiatives to get these kids in school and to get them to stay in school?
The Best Schools Initiative is a community co-created initiative by both by CFK Africa and schools. And what we're basically doing is we want to discover and implement ways to ensure that all children can finish primary school. We are currently implementing four practices, and the practices are basically things such as providing school lunches, providing affordable school fees, providing teacher training, and also, you know, providing increased student to textbook ratio. We're basically providing textbooks in schools kids can access. And the innovation is that many informal schools are not using these practices currently, and no one truly understands what that effect has on students coming to school and staying in school. And so we are providing those practices and studying to what extent do they help kids stay in school and finish school. And what we're doing is, in fact, some almost like a longitudinal study where we'd want to study the effect of either providing lunch or providing books or teacher training. We seek to, you know, have improved outcomes for understanding students in, you know, in Kenya's informal settlement by helping the BSI address structural challenges informal school face. And also the experience will help strengthen the research capacity for our organization, that is CFK Africa, which is critical for our organization becoming a leading organization in education space. And it will also increase the organization's ability to gather and analyze data to inform program interventions basically across all areas within informal settlement. So those are basically the key inspiration that we have moving into this engagement.
And of course, an educated population definitely is good for an entire society.
Absolutely, absolutely. The larger impact is, you know, improved literacy across. And there's just very little that is researched across informal settlement in Kenya, but also across Africa, just because they do not fall within the formal domain. So they're often left out. And so the statistic we end up seeing put on the forefront reflects just either half or less than half of the population. And that's true for across most of the counties in Kenya, because a majority are residents of informal settlement.
CFK Africa Interim Deputy Director of Strategic Initiatives, Jeffrey Okoro, speaking to VOA from Nairobi. Memorial Day is a U.S. holiday dedicated to those who died while serving in America's wars. To commemorate the day, which falls on the last Monday in May, people flocked to Washington to decorate the graves of fallen military service members, attend parades, and visit national monuments. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
American flags decorate the graves of the over 228,000 service members buried at Arlington National Cemetery. For this annual Flags In ceremony, which started in 1948, more than 1,000 soldiers and volunteers place flags in front of the headstones in advance of Memorial Day, a U.S. holiday observed on the last Monday of May, honoring the service members who sacrificed their lives fighting for their country. In Washington, over a dozen military monuments are dedicated to those who died fighting for the United States in conflicts ranging from the American Revolution in the 1700s to modern conflicts like the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and beyond. One of the best-known Memorial Day stops is the Marine Corps War Memorial, featuring a statue modeled after the iconic 1945 photograph of Marines raising the flag on the Japanese island of Iwo Jima during World War II. At the World War II Memorial, stone pillars and bronze wreaths commemorate the more than 400,000 Americans, service members, who fell in that conflict. At the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the names of the more than 58,000 men and women who died serving in that controversial war are etched on an imposing black granite wall. Millions of visitors come to the U.S. Capitol on Memorial Day, not only to mourn the fallen, but also to celebrate the day and have fun. A long-standing tradition in Washington, the National Memorial Day Parade, takes place each year on the National Mall and features military bands and marching units. Memorial Day is also a day of optimism, marking the beginning of the summer season in the U.S. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the earliest casualties of Russia's senseless war on Ukraine, and one of the globally most devastating, was the stoppage of food shipments from Ukraine, the world's fifth largest exporter of wheat and the second largest exporter of sunflower oil, as drought and strife caused unprecedented food insecurity in vulnerable regions around the world. Russia's blockade of Ukrainian ports decimated supplies of food available to aid organizations. With the July 27, 2020 signing of the Black Sea Grain Initiative, brokered by Turkey and the United Nations, exports of Ukrainian grain resumed. But the initiative expires on May 18th, giving Russia the opportunity to again block the passage of cargo ships to and from Ukraine's ports, even before the original agreement expires, and to threaten to pull out of the Black Sea Grain Initiative altogether. We should not need to remind Moscow every few weeks to keep their promises and to stop using people's hunger as a weapon in their war against Ukraine, said United States Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Speaking at a Foreign Press Center briefing on the Black Sea Grain Initiative, Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield said that with over 345 million people facing high levels of food insecurity right now, we are facing a global food crisis. This is a crisis felt most acutely in Africa and the Middle East, and especially by people in countries where food was already in short supply, she said. The point of the Black Sea Grain Initiative is to make sure grain and food supplies get to those in desperate need and to stabilize global markets. The initiative has enabled the export of over 30 million metric tons of foodstuff. Most of it went to various aid organizations, which then delivered desperately needed supplies to those most in need. For example, Ukrainian food fueled the World Food Program's humanitarian operations in Afghanistan, Somalia, and Yemen, saving countless lives. The world needs the Black Sea Grain Initiative, said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. What's more, the world needs Russia to end its illegal war against Ukraine, which would allow farmers to return to their fields, return agricultural trade to normal, and immediately and significantly improve global food security. In the meantime, Russia must stop playing games with the lives of hungry people around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.